welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is how do you use .NET with the broker. Today's presenters are Minsung Bien and Yvette Palmer. Minsung is a software engineer at RTP North Carolina. He has been at IBM for 9 years, the last 6 years of which were as a member of WebSphere Message Broker Level 2 support team. He has a BE degree in chemical engineering from NI University and an MS in computer science from Akron University. Yvette is a software engineer at Baton Rouge, Louisiana. She has been at IBM for 31 years. She has held various technical positions in IBM. For 12 years, she was an IBM WebSphere Message Broker instructor developer and became a member of the WebSphere Message Broker Level 2 support team over a year ago. She has a BS degree in computer science and engineering from Southern University A&M College in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Yvette.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our presentation today. Please turn the page to page 2. We're going to get started. These are the things that we're going to talk about today. In the agenda, we're going to talk about why .NET. We will also look at the .NET overview. That will then allow us to cover the framework and also the common language runtime. Integration with the broker. We will look at how Visual Studio integration is basically integrated with the Message Broker 2 kit. We will look at the broker plug-in APIs, what are available for us from navigation and tree access. What's the common object model access? How do we use ESQL calling .NET? Hosting the common language runtime. And one of the last topics, which is very important, is talking about application domains. And then we'll end up with a summary of the presentation. Please turn the page to 3. So we ask ourselves, why use .NET? Well, we can't fool ourselves. We have a lot of customers out there that have invested, and investments on this particular fall is a key statement that they've invested in Microsoft, .NET, and some other related technologies. Just a minute, mention just a couple of those technologies. We've got CRM ERP, we've got SharePoint, Visual Studio, and then obviously for anything that is, kind of a collaboration, we're gonna have to have a door where we can have user-written applications. As far as application developers are concerned, .NET is very popular to these developers in the small and medium environment. We now have basically opened up our programming languages to now that Message Broker, it basically provides 6 languages now. Before we had the Java, the C, C++, PHP, but now we've opened the gates to where now C# and also Visual Basic can be used, and both of these can be used in the .NET compute node. Please turn to page 4. This looks at a very colorful fall and talks about the .NET framework. And I'd like to start at the bottom of the actual foil. And at the bottom, we have the operating system. And I'm sure all of you understand that when we talk about .NET, basically we're talking about Windows only. So that's the only platform that this is a viable solution for. When we look next at the common language runtime, basically we're saying that this runtime is a virtual machine, similar to Java Virtual Machine. It's obviously a component for the .NET framework, and it manages the .NET programs. It provides us some services, and some of the services that it provides us is threading, garbage collection, exception handling, security loading, and obviously a couple of others. But these are some very important services that they provide at runtime as far as .NET is concerned. On top of that, we have in the green area the base class library. And then in the red area, this is where now we get into some of the particulars here. We've got the ADO.NET. This basically is better known as Active Data Objects. It's basically used by programmers so they can access and modify data that is stored in relational database. The DLR is a dynamic language runtime. It provides us language services. The WCF is Windows Communications Foundation, and it's basically used for the implementation of the services-oriented architecture for SOA. And then lastly, we've got the LinkQ. Now, we've got here, this is for .NET Language Integrated Query. Basically, it's a general-purpose query facility, not just for XML rational or for XML data, but it is basically well-suited for those two. And then one of the last ones I want to talk about is the ASP.NET. And this one here basically allows programmers to build dynamic web services, web applications, and also websites. And you also see that we have a couple of others that are available here. In the next layer, in the purple layer, we have what is known as the Common Language Specification. And this plays a big part here as far as .NET is concerned, because it provides a set of rules that govern the interoperation of types used by the different programming languages. And you can see in the purple on top of that Common Language Specification the languages, obviously, that we are able to use here. So you see the C#, the VB.NET, then you've got the F#, the C++, JScript, and we obviously have 40 other programming languages that we can use. A lot of the older programming languages are now getting some activity with the .NET framework in place. To pull all of this together, on the right side, we see that we've got the Visual Studio tools, and basically this is our integrated development environment tool for development of the .NET code. Can you please change the 4 to 5? The .NET Common Language Runtime. So this is just to kind of go a little bit of deeper into the what we call the CLR. And basically here, the Common Language Runtime, as far as Broker is concerned, we support version 4. All right, so we don't support any other release but version 4. And so obviously we'll take it, you know, farther as we enhance, you know, in using the actual product. The CLR is a virtual machine, as I stated before. It's just like a Java virtual machine, and it's where the actual code is executed. So the code is managed in that CLR. They can be hosted inside another process. Kind of an example of that is an SQL server. So the SQL server will run in the CLR, and it basically will then give it the capability where it can manage stored procedures. And then, as I stated before, we've got a lot of services that are important for you to understand what the CLR provides, the garbage collection, the exception handling, security loading. And we're going to see basically later on in a couple of foils where if we wanted to basically see, you know, what activity is running on the CLR, you know, how do we capture that garbage collection. And we do have the resource statistics that will basically allow us to do that. Please turn the page to 6. Now we've got to look at, basically, we've got the source code. So we said that the Common Language Specification was, you know, getting us some set of rules that governs the interoperation of the types for the different programming languages. So for all of these different languages, we're going to have some rules that govern them. And so basically, we're saying here that .NET code is compiled from source language into managed seal, and so that is basically called the managed common intermediate language. And so basically with us getting everyone at that even keel of compiling your source language there, that kind of like sets, you know, kind of a, you know, a boundary for us there. The common type systems and the common language specifications also play here with the common language specifications. The common type system, the key word here is type in that word, and it says it defines the actual rules that the CLR basically use when it's either going to declare, maybe using, or managing any of the types. And then your common language specification, we already said, was basically, you know, the rules that govern it. The seal code basically lives in either a DLL or the DLL or the EXE, and this is basically called an assembly. basically what happens is that your source code, for example, like C Sharp or Visual Basic, is compiled, and the output is going to be a DLL or an EXE. That assembly is going to be loaded, and it's going to be executed in the CLR. It also states here that the code is going to be jitted before it's executed, and that's just one of the processes that's happening underneath the covers for us. And then basically the key thing here to understand is that at runtime, it doesn't matter what source language you use. So, you know, one programmer might want to use C Sharp, another might want to use Visual Basic because they've got the skills when they're going to be actually dealing with .NET. And so the key thing here is that the DLL or the EXE is going to be what's executed, and so that's going to be what's used in the CLR. Again, just to repeat this, the CLR, as far as Message Broker is concerned, we're supporting the version for release of this product. Can you turn to page 7, please? Now, how about integrating .NET with Message Broker? Well, obviously, we've got a type, you know, language agnostic integration with the actual CLR language at a very low level in the actual broker here. It basically can create its own .NET compute nodes using Visual Studio. We're going to look at basically Visual Studio and also the toolkit a little bit later on, and basically how do we use that .NET compute node. We can have either create some new or some existing .NET applications directly with the message flow. We can also write some nodes if we like in any of the languages that are supported here. We have a tightly coupling between the Visual Studio and the toolkit where we can, in the toolkit, launch the Visual Studio, kind of similar to when we put a Java compute node in a message flow and we say open Java. Well, here we're going to be opening the Microsoft Visual Studio. The Visual Studio plug-in, basically, it's going to simplify our node development for us here. We're also going to be able to use .NET code so that we can execute some eSQL. So, you know, maybe I don't have the skills of, you know, C Sharp or Visual Basic, and so I know eSQL. And so how come I can't use a compute node and then basically jump straight into eSQL? And that's just one of the flexibilities that we have here as far as .NET is concerned. So you have a lot of flexibility here. At the bottom we have basically just an example of a message flow, kind of showing you a couple of different ways in how .NET can be used. We see the first node here is a compute node, and it's going to have some eSQL written in it that's going to then execute some .NET code. And then further on past the SOAP request node, we've got two .NET nodes, and basically we've named them to handle success and handle fault, and we'll see this example later on in the presentation, but these are just the nodes that we can choose from the actual template so that we can then program .NET capability in our message flow. Please turn to flow 8. All right, managing .NET integration. You basically need a way in order for you to be able to control .NET, all right, in the integration from the toolkit to the Visual Studio tooling. And so we've got a configurable service. Now, we have a configurable service here that can be created, and it's used to start the CLR. Later on, we're going to talk about application domains. We also have a configurable service that we can use for the application domain. So through resource statistics, we'll see that we can turn that on, and we can capture garbage collection for the entire .NET CLR. And then you also have activity tracing. So we've got a couple of tools here that you're able to use so that you can manage the actual .NET integration here. As far as the CLR is concerned, it is hosted in each execution group. So when an execution group is started, all right, there's going to be one CLR that's going to be present in that execution group. Now, that's provided that you have, when you installed Message Broker version 8, that the actual CLR code was installed. So there are some things that you've got to do to make sure that that's installed. But if it's present, then that CLR basically will be resident and then will be in each one of the execution groups. But that's just, you know, by default if you've done that. Each one of the CLRs, they are split into different application domains. We're going to talk about that's one of our major topics at the end of the presentation. So you're going to have to choose which application domain you're going to run in. And if you look at the little diagram at the bottom, this is a representation of where we've taken a snapshot of resource statistics. And if you look at the third tab, it says CLRGC. And below that, you will see, in summary, three different domains. So we've got a default domain, a .NET Compute application domain, and then a .NET Compute 2 application domain. And we'll talk about those three later on, but this is just to show you that you're going to have multiples, and then basically you're going to have to choose which one that you're going to have your CLR to run into. Please change the file to screen 9. Now let's look at this .NET Compute node. Why do you integrate, or why would you want to integrate today? Well, the .NET Compute node is very similar to the Java Compute node. We already said that the CLR was a virtual machine, so it's got a Java virtual machine here. So with this .NET Compute node being similar to the Java Compute node, basically it's going to give us some transformation capability. We can write our transformations in any CLR-compliant library. So with the actual programming languages that we support, we can actually pull some templates out so that we can then write our code in any one of those programming languages that we choose. Also, another thing that is similar to the Java Compute node is that we get three templates. And the templates is a filter message, a modify, and then a create. Each one of those templates basically are available to us, but again, just like in the Java Compute node, you have to choose one. So if I'm going to first maybe filter the message, then I would have a .NET Compute node, and then if I needed to then, say, modify the message, I would have to have a second .NET Compute node. So remember, you can only perform one, you know, executable function in each one of those .NET Compute nodes here, because no one, you know, just one template can be used per .NET Compute node. Basically, we have a single method. It's called the evaluate method that is implemented as far as Visual Studio is concerned. And then if you needed to be able to access any of the broker trees, then you've got all of them. You've got full access to all of those broker trees. So you've got message, local environment, environment exception list, and then you've got the shared row variables. Now, we do have, just like most of the actual nodes in Message Broker, we've got some terminals that are available to you that are basically static. But let's say you needed to create you some dynamic terminals. Well, you have that capability also on the .NET Compute node, that you can create some dynamic terminals and then give them some names. And then basically, you know, you kind of have an unlimited option here as far as that is concerned. This is just showing you just a representation of, you know, some of the .NET nodes. And you can see that basically, you know, we're using one for SharePoint. We're inserting a CRM. And this is just, you know, giving them a different function that they're going to be able to execute for us. It doesn't mean they have to all be written in the same programming language. It just says that, you know, these are the kind of functions that you can use them for. Please turn to screen 10. Now let's look at how do you configure this .NET Compute node. Well, basically, I'm sure we're all familiar with using the Broker Toolkit. So at the top part, we would then basically be in the message flow that we want to then put this .NET Compute node in. So we would go into the transformation drawer here, or the folder, and then you would see the .NET Compute node. So you can drag and drop that to the actual canvas. Now, once you've dragged and dropped it, then basically at the bottom, we know if we can click on that node, and we can then say, I want to obviously set what the properties are. So at the bottom, one of the key properties for this .NET Compute node is the assembly name. You do have the browse button here that will allow you to go out and find the DLL or the EXE that you want to use. One of the key things here that you have to remember, and what you see on this example, is that on the assembly name, it's got a fully qualified path. And so that's important that you make sure that you use that. Now, there is also a class name. It's important also, but the most important thing here is that assembly name. What DLL are you going to use at runtime for the .NET Compute node that's going to be obviously used in the CLR? The class name, if you're going to fill this in, that name must not include the .cs extension. So we know the class name has a .cs extension, so it's not necessary when you add that in here on the actual properties. You also have another option where you can drag and drop an assembly on the node to configure. So what this is saying is that basically I've got a compute node in my message flow. And instead of me taking the .NET and putting it on the canvas, now I can go kind of like a reverse. I can put a compute node on the actual message on the canvas, and then now I can take that assembly, and then I can drag it onto the actual node, and then basically it will then configure the actual node for me. So it will then identify my DLL or my EXE for me, and I think we do have an example of how that works later on in the presentation. But those are just the two ways that basically that you can configure the .NET node here. Can we move on to 411? So when we launched the Visual Studio, all right, we said that we've basically taken a .NET compute node and we've placed it on in the message flow canvas. And so right from this .NET Compute node, we'd like to be able to launch the Microsoft Visual Studio. So if we right-click on that node, you can see all of the different options that you can then choose from. And one of the key ones that we're looking at is to open the Microsoft Visual Studio. So it's just either a double-click on the node itself or just right-clicking and then choosing Open Microsoft Visual Studio. Please turn to screen 12. Okay, so the Visual Studio integration, very important aspect of .NET because the Visual Studio tooling basically gives us a really nice front end for us to be able to, as a developer, for them to be able to develop their .NET code here. So that the studio and the toolkit basically is going to help us to develop the .NET assemblies here. The Visual Studio is the industry standard for .NET development, so you know we're going to find a lot of developers that that's what they're going to be using. There is tight integration with the Broker runtime. As we stated, you can double-click or you can then go to the actual node and then you can launch the Visual Studio so that then it can then open and then basically provide you the options that you need to specify. The node can be figured with a solution to launch it automatically. You also have some plugins. So plugins are very key here for Visual Studio. Obviously, you have the skeleton and for the .NET compute node. And so these are our three templates. So you've got the filter, the modify, and the create. Now, with having these skeletons and having so many different languages that we're going to be able to program in, that's where then it's going to look a little bit different. And we'll show you an example of that so that let's say I'm going to, you know, use Visual Studio and I'm going to use the template to do a filter, but I'm going to use C#. But then one of my colleagues wants to use C++. Well, then obviously when you go in into the actual Visual Studio, you're going to have to choose, okay, what's the actual template you're going to use, and then what's the programming language, just so that then, you know, that's to say that we've got very particular, you know, templates here for one programming language over another. We do have a Visual Studio debugger so that you can debug your .NET assemblies. That debugger basically is attached at runtime to the dataflow engine.exe process, so that's attached to the execution group. And just like we debug anything else, we're able to see all the message trees in its entirety. Now, it looks a little bit different, and we'll see an example of that. But basically, it's all because it's, you know, .NET assemblies. And then one of the nice things that we have here as far as development is concerned is we've got what's called the hot swap. Now, I have another screen later on in the presentation where we'll talk about more details and the steps. But this is a very simplified method that allows me to simply rebuild. I go in, I develop my code, you know, I test it, I see something's wrong, and then when I see something wrong, I'm like, oh, I need to change it. So HotSwap is going to basically allow me to go in, make that change. It's going to then update the DLL or the EXE, all right, and then basically not have to then stop the execution group and restart it. That's cumbersome. So this is a very good tool that we have, especially for developers, so that they can then, you know, kind of get speed up the development process here. Please turn the file to file 13. So this shows you here in the Visual Studio tooling basically three templates. So as I stated before, you're going to get the filter, the message, and then also the modify, and then the message. And so here I'm saying as a developer, I'm going to use the C#. And so I'm going to then see here the actual C# templates that, and you can see the purple color here indicates that they are for the message broker because that's kind of like one of our colors we use. But this shows you those templates that you would then actually choose. So, you know, basically what's happened here is that you've created a new Visual Studio project. So you did a file, new project, integration steps. And then when the template panel appears, then you're going to navigate to whatever programming language that you're going to use. And so here I chose the C#. And then basically now there's going to be another pane that's going to open up, and it's going to allow you to select to create a message broker message, all right, depending upon, you know, which one of the templates you're going to use. So you'll fill in a name, and you'll have a project name in the panel. And then basically now you can go on and you can then actually start writing your code. So this template, you know, it's going to look and feel kind of like what we're used to seeing with Java. You're going to have a skeleton template, and then it's going to have the location where you're going to be able to then write your actual code. Please turn the file to 14. The Visual Studio browser basically is one thing that is very key for when we want to view the broker.NET APIs. So, you know, I mean, the APIs are kind of standard as far as programming and, you know, development is concerned. And so Visual Studio, we have the .NET APIs here that are available. On the right side of the screen, you see it says IBM.broker.plugin. And so that's kind of like the beginning of where you will find the broker.NET APIs. And then from there, you've got several different options. We have then opened up the NB elements so that we can then basically look at the elements in the logical view of the message. And so by us choosing the NB element, then on the right-hand side here, we see, you know, all of the different values. And then also at the bottom, you see the parameters. So based upon whatever value you choose at the top that's highlighted. So we chose the create last child. And so at the bottom it shows you then what parameters would be passed at the time if you would use this .NET API. Please change the file to 15. Content Assist, one of the greatest things that I'm sure most developers like to use, helps you write your statements. So here we kind of see an example of we're in Visual Studio. We've got the template here. We see the evaluate method that we said that basically comes with the .NET compute node. And so we've got an area here right above that red area where it says you can add your user code. So to begin to using Content Assist here in this skeleton, all you have to do is type in root dot and then, again, press the control and the space bar. And then you will see then the pull down that will then help you to then, you know, write your actual .NET code here that you're going to be using. Now, I always tell people, you know, when I was teaching my message broker classes before, now we can't finish it. We can take you to a certain point as far as the content assist is concerned, but you're the developer, you're the programmer, so you're going to have to make sure that you understand what you're trying to accomplish here in writing that statement. So you're going to have to finish off that line of code. Please turn the fall to fall 16. Here in Visual Studio, we said we had the Visual Studio debugger. So here, basically, we have set a breakpoint. So we can go in, just as we go into eSQL or the Java Compute Node, and we can then basically set a breakpoint. So we set a breakpoint here at line number 24. The line that's highlighted here is the NB element, output root element equals output message.root element. And so basically when the execution gets to that particular statement in this code, it's going to stop. And so to the left of that, you'll see the locals. And the locals here basically is going to identify for us, you know, the actual information that's being used here for that particular line here. So you can see what's the actual values that have been set. This is kind of, you know, helping you to determine, you know, is something wrong here? Am I seeing what I'm supposed to be seeing based upon the code that's executed? So, you know, this is no different than anything else that we've used as far as the broker is concerned here. Another thing that the studio debugger is going to be able to help us with here is that it can help us to examine the stack backtrace. We can also single step. So if I need to then, you know, get to step 24 and then now I need to step through my remainder of the actual code that's in this .NET compute node, then I can do that, okay? Or I can then basically at this point, you know, visually see what's been set and then I can take it to completion at this point. And then, you know, obviously see what my end result is. If you need to stop the Visual Studio debugger, you would just choose in this perspective, you would just choose debug and then say stop debugging. Can you please turn to 4017? Now let's get down to talking about programming the broker with the .NET APIs. Here we're saying that APIs are, you know, essential as far as, you know, the programming is concerned here. So the API is the design. You know, it's got standard look and feel, you know, for the APIs. It does follow the Microsoft Framework design guidelines. Basically, we're going to see where we can use properties where appropriate. We also have where it's going to follow naming conventions. Another thing that it will use is, you know, shows, you know, the mix case, which is something that's kind of standard here. So the reason why you've got these guidelines and these standards is because, you know, you just want to allow these programmers to become very familiar with the requirements. It is also designed to be usable as many .NET languages as possible. So that, again, is just nothing but the framework. So if we choose a plug-in assembly, it's going to be marked as CLS compliant. Let's say we choose one that's not CLS compliant. Well, then basically there's alternatives that's going to be offered to you, and then you can choose from that alternative, you know, what's the best one that's suited here. Very simple but powerful capability as far as the APIs are concerned. At the bottom in the yellow, we see the mbparser.xmlnsc. Here we're going to create an XML declaration. Here we have one line. We're saying we're setting an actual element. We're specifying what the version is, what the UTF is, and then also we want standalone to equal yes. So here's one line of code, whereas just think about it, if this was Java, you might have to have six, maybe eight lines of code in order for you to be able to get this done. So this just shows you that it's very simple but powerful at the same time when it's going to get into the actual development of what you're trying to accomplish here. Can you turn the floor to page 18? this just kind of shows us the message broker tree here. Now, kind of at a low-level access, when we want to basically move up and down the actual message tree, then we've got several different properties. So I think these, the actual property names that we're seeing here are not too foreign to us. We're kind of probably familiar with them if you're used to eSQL. So you see parent, last child, first child, previous sibling, next sibling. Those are just some of them. But basically, what they help you to do is for you to be able to move up and down the actual message itself here. We can have these chained so that we can get to a specific element. So in the yellow, we've got an example that we were saying MB element amount equals root. So we see, we know the message always starts at root, and then we're saying go to the last child, to the last child, to the last child. And basically what that would then bring back as information to us would be the 5,000 in the amount. So this gives us easy, you know, capability for us to get to a certain location in the actual message here. Also, another key point that I need to mention here is that the properties return either the element, you know, its value here, or it can return null. So that just means that, you know, if you reference some actual element that doesn't exist, then it's going to return back to you null. Please turn to page 19. Handling the exceptions are very easy here as far as .NET is concerned. The broker exceptions are turned into what we call NB exceptions, so they can be caught in the .NET code here. You can catch the exceptions using a try-catch node if you so desire, so you can wire that, or you can also have a catch terminal if you need that. And you can see the particulars as far as the NB exceptions. You have an NB recoverable exception, NB user exception, and then NB, and then this would be defining, you know, whatever your exception is, if you wrote some exception routine. The NB exceptions are turned into broker exceptions if thrown out of the .NET code. And so this is basically saying that you can leave your .NET code with exceptions if necessary. Okay. And then the last bullet talks about the .NET exceptions are turned into broker exceptions if thrown out of the user.NET. So maybe a little bit confusing here, but whenever we look at this, we're saying message broker exceptions can be turned into .NET exceptions and vice versa. So that this just shows the compatibility and the framework work guidelines that basically that are governing the .NET code here. So we can either go either way. We can have message broker exceptions or we can have .NET exceptions, but they'll obviously be turned into the opposite depending upon the exception type here. Please move to FOIL 19. Now, this just shows us an example here of how you can use eSQL with .NET and declaring an actual method. So I have the capability with eSQL that I can use a create function or I can use a create procedure statement in the node, and it's going to, obviously, it's supporting eSQL, and I can call .NET from any nodes that support eSQL. So this could be in a compute node, or it could be, let's see, what else? What else do we have eSQL for? I'm drawing a blank here, but for the greatest example is the compute node. So you write this eSQL or this function or procedure, and so this basically allows you to call your procedure. So you've got to give the procedure a name, so we gave it .NET method, and then we've got anytime you have procedures or functions, you have what? You have in, out, and in, out values, so we've got those defined. The one key thing that is very important here is the language. We know that whenever we're dealing with Java and we want Java to then be used in eSQL, we have to have the language, and it has to say Java. Well, nothing different here. The language has to say .NET. And then basically you've got here your external name. This identifies your method. The assembly, so that's something that's unique here as far as the eSQL is concerned for the .NET because we have an assembly. We said that you know, this assembly, all right, this DLL or the EXE that we're going to be using has to be identified. That was one of the key things that we said on the property of the actual node. So it's nothing different here, so you have to identify. And then also the application domain can be identified. Now, you don't have to choose that, so that is an optional thing here. But if you do choose it, then it can be identified in your eSQL code. You can also do a drag drop of an assembly, as we stated before, in the compute node, and it, guess what, would generate all of this eSQL code for you. So that then, you know, you wouldn't have to worry about any finger checks or if you've coded anything wrong. So as long as you've got the assembly, put the compute node in there, drag that assembly onto the compute node, and it auto-generates all of this information for you. Please turn 4021. Okay, so on here we're looking at eSQLcalling.net making the call. So there's nothing, you know, that is particular as far as making a call here using the eSQL with .NET. So here we just see in the example we've declared a couple of, you know, integers. We've given them their actual values, and then we just see the actual call statement. And when we're doing the call, again, we've got what? Our in, our out, in, out, in, out values that we basically saw before when we declared the method. We're now using those when we're going to actually call it. So these the call static methods, they have compatible types. Okay, if you're interested in looking at those, you can look in the Info Center, and there is a table on the mappings that basically kind of shows you side by sides when you're, you know, actually looking at what is it, you know, what does this actual element looks like if you're going to do the development for it in CLR or if you're going to do it in .NET. So you can see that in the actual Info Center. This is very similar to eSQL calling Java. You have also nillable or non-nillable data types be used from the eSQL. And then also we've got a couple of optional things, like the optional syntax can specify the application domain. And then also your assembly properties can be used here, like the version, the culture, or the public key token. Please turn to 4022. What about hosting the CLR in the execution group? So now we're getting to the point where we've possibly, you know, written our code, and now we're ready to then be able to deploy this. So the common language runtime, the CLR, we said it's like the JVM. So that CLR is going to be hosted in each execution group. It's always loaded if it's present on the box. And what that means is that by default, when you install the broker code on Windows, it will install the CLR code that will allow it to be loaded at startup. So that means that, you know, there's one less step that you have to worry about it. But it's because you've been at install time, you made sure that the CLR code was installed. It's not an error if not present, but that just means that no .NET code is going to be executed. And also, one of the key things that's important here is that we said that we support CLR version 4 as far as Microsoft is concerned. So we have to have, you know, the full load of the .NET framework. The client version is not going to work for us here. So just make sure that you've got the full version here. That CLR basically here is loaded in the IBM main on the main thread of the execution group at the startup. And at the bottom of the screen, you can see the resource statistics. Again, this is just a snapshot, and this just shows you that you've got the CLR GC and just giving us some summary information as far as the statistics that was captured at the time, you know, for the entire CLR. Now let's move to 4.23. Now this is where we're going to start talking about application domains, and application domains are very key, very, very key. The application domains are runtime containers for the .NET assemblies. And basically, you know, we have associated resources that are used by the .NET message flows. So here we're saying that a default application domain is created by CLR. So we can see down at the bottom in our square that we have a default domain. So that one was created by the CLR for us. But we have a couple of other domains. We've got a domain that's called ESQL. We have one that's called .NET App. And then we also have one that's a shared neutral domain. Now, shared neutral just means that, you know, if I've got a DLL, which I do have there in the picture, ibm.broker.support.dll, that just means that it's shared between the application domains. So anything in that domain can be shared. But we have these other three domains. And if you look at the message flow example, we've got an application with a message flow in it called .NET App. And so we've got a compute node, and then we've got two .NET nodes in the message flow. So in this eSQL application domain, we see that we've got two DLLs, and we've got the DLL for the library assembly and then also for the IBM plugin, broker.plugin.dll. And so that application domain is strictly for the compute node. So when I get to that node, then basically that's the domain that I'm going to then, you know, be using the information, the DLLs from there. Likewise, when I go over to the two .NET compute nodes, I've got two. One that says handle success, the other says handle fault. Both of those run in a separate application domain. And what we see here is the name of that application domain is called .NET App. Now, the reason why it has the name of .NET App is because this message flow is in an application. Okay? Now, if this message flow was not part of an application, then the application domain would be the name of the execution group. So in this case, it would be execution group 1. So anytime a message flow is part of an application, and then basically that particular code is then now deployed to the execution group, you're going to see the application domain name take up on the name of the actual name of this message flow here. All right? Otherwise, if there is no application domain being used and the message flow is not part of a application, it's going to take up on the execution group name and name that as the application domain. Okay? Now, one other thing about application domains is that basically it provides us a scoping point. And so this just says that basically it's a subprocess, kind of unit of isolation for us to be able to manage code so that we can unload, reload, and then basically also share the data here. So I've already talked about the example at the bottom. We know that the CLR is running inside of the execution group. We stated that there is one per execution group, and then we see that we have four, you know, application domains that are present here. Now, it doesn't mean that every time we deploy a message flow that's got maybe a compute node with .NET code and some .NET compute nodes in the message flow that we're going to have all four of these domains. This just shows you basically the full, you know, picture here as far as if you did have that, how many domains that would be present here. Please turn to page 24. Now, some additional information about the application domain. So we said that application domains was a unit of scoping for all your .NET code. All right. Application domains have several properties. So they have a name and then also a base directory where the code in the application domain lives. There also can be an optional configuration file here so they can provide, you know, extra information for code running in that actual domain. The application domains can be created by the name, and so this just explains what I just talked about. It says, if unnamed, a domain will be named after the broker application the flow is a part of. Okay? Here it says also application domains can be created by a configurable service. We talked about that on the early part of the presentation. And then also here we can specify the application domain properties. We've got the hot swap, for the .NET assembly, which gives us a shadow copy. So this is basically, you know, that eliminates all that fuss when we're testing. So we can basically now make a change and then, you know, have the reload of the assembly. And then basically what happens is this .NET compute node sees the change of the date. And so it basically says, okay, now I'm going to take the new DLL instead of the old one. And so this just helps us to speed up the development time. And then also the resource statistics is available here so that we can get a, you know, a full picture of what the CLR is doing at the time of runtime here. Please turn to page 24 of ITAR 25. So on page 25, this just shows us the hot swap and how it works with your assemblies. So here in step one, basically you're on the Visual Studio tooling, and so you're building your actual code. So you're going to have your assembly do something, some functionality. You know, you might have something special that you're coding in here. Once you've done that, then you're going to generate the code and you're going to receive down in the lower portion of this, at the lower right, you see myassembly.dll. So you've got that DLL. That is obviously then going to be put to the actual disk, okay? The next thing you're going to have to do is you're going to have to take that .NET compute node, and you're going to have to point it to the assembly that's sitting on the disk. Now you're able to then do the deploy. So you deploy the message flow that's got the .NET compute node in it. You perform a test, maybe send a message, you know, actually see what your results are. And so in looking at that, you say to yourself, it's not the result that I was looking for. And so because it's not the result, you're saying, okay, let me go back in Visual Studio and let me see, okay, I understand what changes I have to make. So you're back in Visual Studio, you make your changes, and you're saying, okay, I don't want to have to restart the execution group and redeploy the actual message flow that's got the .NET compute node. So that's where this hot swap becomes very important, because it says, okay, obviously the flow is stopped. So when the flow starts again, has the new changes in it, okay, the .NET compute node pauses the flow. And I said it, yes, it pauses the flow. And the date, all right, has changed on this myassembly.dll, because when you went back in and you made your changes, then now you had to then go and say, okay, give me another myassembly.dll, because you've made some changes to it. So I don't want the old one. I want this new one to be used. So when that flow starts again, that .NET, it pauses, it checks the actual disk where the DLL is stored, and then basically it picks up that new DLL. It now then uses that, okay, which eliminates me having to redeploy, to stop and restart the execution group, all right? So the bottom line here is that, you know, it eliminates all that cumbersome, you know, those steps and things that we have to perform here in some other cases. It eliminates that for us with this hot swap and giving us the new assembly here. So it does check the disk, looks at the dates and times, and it sees that it's something new, so it's going to use the new one as opposed to using the old one. So that ought to be really cool. We ought to see if we can't get this code kind of duplicated somewhere else in Message Broker for us, eliminate some of the headaches we've got. But let's move on to page number 26. So here we said the .NET, we have a configurable service. And so if you look here, we're looking at the MQ Explorer. And so if you look under the broker, we've got our configurable services. And so we've got a .NET application domain. So we can have a configurable service where we can start the CLR. And then basically here, this just gives you kind of a peek at, you know, the application domain, how it's set up from a configurable service so that it can be started also. So that's one of the things that would be nice, that would obviously eliminate you having to make sure, you know, that you have everything set up. So you can see, you know, some of the key things here is that, you know, it's got to have a name. It's going to then ask you, you got an option here. Do you want to allow hot swap deploy? I would think you would, okay? I don't know when you would want to do that so that you could, have, faster, changes being made so that you could redeploy and test again. And then you can see, where is the actual application base. And then there are a couple of other properties. Now, obviously, the configurable service here, okay, we're saying here that allow hot swap deploy and the shadow copy files should be true here for the hot swap. So those are some of the key things that you see here, that the shadow copy files is true, and then the allow hot swap deploy is also true. So that allows, with those two set in place, and we're able to do that hot swap. Okay, let's move to our last foil, number 27. So that takes us to the end of the presentation, where basically we've talked about the .NET integration here, very tight integration for the common language runtime. Version 4 is what we're using here as far as Microsoft is concerned. That CLR is hosted inside the execution group. The .NET code is executed natively inside of the actual broker. The CLR supports many different languages here so that you can create nodes. Some of the, basic languages that customers have been kind of chomping at the bit that they want to use, and it's primarily because they've got the skills. They've got skills when it comes to C# and Visual Basic, so they want to use that. So now skill becomes something that is very, highly looked at when we're going to development, because if you've got the skill, then that's where you're going to then basically use them and not have to worry about learning something new here. So that's always good. We've got an integrated application domain support here. You've got large APIs that's going to provide access to message broker facilities for navigation, also for element creation, and then also for exception handling. And then as far as the Visual Studio integration is concerned, we've said that there was a tightly coupling between the toolkit and Visual Studio. The Studio is obviously launched from Eclipse. There are plugins that basically provide us fast node creation. You also have Content Assist with the API that allows us to be able to, go in and write our statements, okay? And then also debugging is also a part of the Visual Studio. That is the end of the presentation here, but we also do have on page 28 some additional WebScript product resources. We're probably having web services support technical exchanges on a weekly basis, so I would suggest that you, visit that website here so that you can see, what other topics are going to be discussed, for the remainder of this year. You can also look out on the next link. It says discover some last trends for the WebSphere technology and implementation. We've got where you can join the global WebSphere community. We've also got some show me demos, some tutorials, and IBM Education Assistant. So just like this is going to be recorded, we've got the IBM Education Assistant that basically kind of takes it module by module and shows you some, things that are important as far as the message broker is concerned. This, you can view the webcast replay with step-by-step instructions for using the service request tool. And then lastly, you can also sign up to receive weekly technical notifications, for any other WebSphere tech support technical exchanges. I will now turn the presentation back over to David.
Thank you, Yvette, for a great presentation. And finally, don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with the subject WSTE Subscribe to get a list of mailing lists and to subscribe. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You can also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program even better for you. Thanks again for your participation. As we move to the question and answer session, I'd like to remind you that if you joined us via the web conference, you can also post your questions in the group chat. Precedence will be given to questions asked through the phone, and if time permits, we will also address questions in the group chat. At this time, Carissa, we would like to open the lines for questions.
I show no questions at this time.
Thank you, Carissa. I also do not see any questions in the web conference. So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation, and we hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Min Sung and Yvette, for presenting today.
Thank you.
Thank you.